And as you see, yet another panel. To my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm still Leanne Dofino. And you are our final case set for oral submission today. We appreciate you being here. I understand both sides are ready.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, if you'll call the case, we'll get started. Marshall.
It pleases the court. Certainly an honor to appear before this wonderful court and argue against my dear old friend, Mr. Gilstrap, even though he perhaps still lingers in the shadows of mistake on some of these things. This is a permissive interlocutory appeal. It presents a single issue for this court's decision, the construction of a consent clause in a limited partnership agreement. That is a clear question of law. We believe that both sound logic and correct grammar square with our interpretation of that consent clause and require its adoption. Briefly, an overview of some of the essential facts. My client, Texas Health Ventures, is the general partner and majority owner of the limited partnership interest in a limited partner that operates an outpatient surgery center in Arlington, Texas. The plaintiffs are dissident limited partners that own a small portion of that limited partnership interest. Everyone agrees that the financial viability of that operation is dependent upon surgical referrals from its limited partners, all of whom are treating physicians. This is submitted by an eligibility requirement that exists both in the partnership agreement and under federal law that requires one-third of inpatient surgery by each limited partner to be conducted in the outpatient facility. In 2007, a group of orthopedic surgeons in Arlington who were limited partners announced their plans to build, close by, an inpatient facility. Acting pursuant to the provisions of the limited partnership, they sought the consent of my client to invest in that arguably or potentially competitive operation. That presented a Hobson's choice because they also made clear that if consent was not given, they would simply exercise their clear ability and abandon the partnership and go leaving with their patronage and their referrals. Given that Hobson's choice, of course, consent was given. It retained the referrals of the orthopedic group to the continued benefit of the partnership. Indeed, an unrequired vote was taken by the general partner of the disinterested limited partner, and it received affirmative approval from a majority of the limited partners, including many of the plaintiffs who are now in this case. More than a half a decade later, this lawsuit was filed, claiming that there's somehow a breach of the contract because of the consensual or the consent that was given by the general partner. Now, our position is simple. A promisee that has the discretion to decide whether contractually prohibited action should be allowed as a matter of plain grammar and clear logic, is accorded the discretion to either consent or withhold consent. The partnership agreement is, I think, clear on that. It accords the general partner almost exclusive operational control in sections 10.1 and 10.2. Indeed, the general partner has the unquestioned discretion to decide whether to assert or abandon partnership claims under 10.2Q of the agreement. The agreement contains a broad exculpatory clause, and indeed the LPs are expressly precluded from any role in the management. And this, of course, makes perfect sense. The general partner is the largest owner, owning more than 50% of the limited partnership interest. It bears the entirety of the financial risk of the operation. And it must exercise that control, lest the limiteds lose their limited liability for over-exuberant action in the partnership. Affiliates of the general partner under 10.5 of the agreement are expressly given the right to aggressively compete with the partnership. And indeed, that would be required under federal law. The clause that we deal with is section 12.1, which prevents a limited partner from having ownership in a potentially competitive enterprise without the consent of the general partner. And that brings me to point one of my two-point argument, the illogic of the plaintiff's construction. Consent clauses, and we see them everywhere, from anti-assignment provisions in contracts to the anti-trade provisions in baseball contracts. But all of these consent provisions arise from what I say are a common nucleus of facts and involve highly similar conditions. They usually involve the right to engage in specific conduct. That is, assign a contract, trade a baseball player, or invest in a competitive enterprise, which the promisor has the right to do. But the contract contains a provision which requires, that precludes that action unless consent is received from what I call the promisee. Well, one thing is clear, that the matter that is in issue is whether or not the prohibited conduct can be engaged in. And another thing that is clear is that the promisee, whether there's a consent clause or not, always has the discretion, if you will, to allow the prohibited conduct. For example, you can waive it or just simply not enforce the prohibition. Take the baseball player. The team trades him. They trade him from the 1954 Pittsburgh Pirates to the New York Yankees. And he says, well, you didn't have my consent, but I'm happy you traded me, so I'm not going to enforce it. Take the assignment of contractual rights. Someone assigns contractual rights without any consent clause, or in prohibition of a consent clause. But it's always in the discretion of the promisee to allow that to go forward. It is only when the reverse occurs that some question might arise. That is, when the consent clause is exercised in such a fashion as to veto or preclude the prohibited action. I don't agree to the trade. I don't agree to the assignment. Now, many times the law will either imply or the parties will agree that some standard will govern that veto, such as good faith, reasonableness. But in this contract, our contract, it's clear that that was given exclusively to the discretion of the general partner. So we submit that it becomes totally illogical to suggest that one side of the decisional coin can be exercised, but the other side can't, unless there's adherence to some undescribed, inarticulated standard. That simply makes no sense.
Mr.
The liberation.
I have a question.
Forgive me, Justice, certainly.
In construing contracts, we are supposed to apply the general rules of construction and also look to the party's intent as a whole. And as far as I can tell, there's nothing in the partnership agreement talking about the general partner's right of consent other than this one provision. Is that correct?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. And here's why. Section 12.1 deals not so much with consent or withholding consent. It deals with the decision to allow the prohibited conduct. And Section 12.1 makes it clear that that decision is entrusted to the sole discretion of the general partner. And if I may use an example.
Okay, defining it in your terms then, there's nothing else in the contract, nothing else in the partnership agreement.
I would argue.
I mean, I think it pivots on this one section is what I'm saying.
Correct. I agree.
Okay.
I agree. And I would say that there is a great shining light given by Section 10.2Q, which makes clear that it's always in the sole discretion of the general partner whether to assert or not assert partnership claims. But I do agree with the court's conclusion. So that brings me back that it's illogical. The liberation of the right to hold consent does not in any way contract the liberality of the right to grant consent. To so hold is just simply illogical. So that brings me to point two of my argument. Secondly, it's grammatically flawed to construe the provision in the manner in which the plaintiffs would have the court do. Now, it's with some degree of reluctance that I rely upon my third grade English teacher, my beloved Miss Funderburg, or as she preferred, Frau Funderburg. She would call this, the construction that has been given to this language, the use of impermissible paradox. She would point to the fact that the decision of whether to allow conduct is committed to the general partner, not the outcome of that decision. To interpret language to read that the promisee has sole discretion to go one way, but not to go the other, is the height of what we call, in grammar, misuse of paradox. It may be wonderful for an author such as Oscar Wilde to say paradoxical statements such as, I've always been able to restrain myself from everything but temptation. But when you use that in a contract, it becomes absolutely ludicrous, ambiguous, and impossible to enforce. This interpretation, in fact, would eliminate the consent clause. Likewise, it's argued by the plaintiffs that somehow or another, if that had been the intent, they would have put in, quote, or grant in the applicable language of 12.1. But again, in the words of a grammatist, which sadly on most occasions I'm not, but on this occasion, that would be what is called pleonastic syntactical error, because it is a redundancy. Again,
all that in third grade. There's no way.
We had very advanced schools up there in McKinney.
Paradox.
But just consider this example. Many times before this court, there will become questions of whether or not a trial court has permissibly admitted or impermissibly admitted cumulative evidence, or permissibly or impermissibly excluded cumulative evidence. What the court does in each case is it applies an abuse of discretion standard. And the application of that standard is not based upon whether the evidence is admitted or excluded. It's whether the decision was made outside of the discretion of the trial court. And that's where we are here. It makes no sense to say that you can make one decision, go one way, and you have total discretion to do it. But on the other hand, you don't have total discretion to go the other way. That is, in the words of Grammatist, both paradoxical and pleonastic. That pretty well dispels the expressio unius argument that is made by the plaintiff in their brief. Because clearly, oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thanks. Frank?
It pleases the court. I agree with counsel. When the doctor defendants, the orthopedic surgeons who wanted to jump ship and open their own new facility, which was going to perform outpatient surgery 1.5 miles down the road, and went to the general partner, which is a creature of Baylor, it's not independent in any way, Baylor faced Hobson's choice. They were our fiduciary. The general partner is the fiduciary of the limited partner. They owed us a fiduciary duty to enforce this provision, which prohibits any of the doctors from jumping ship and opening their own facility within a 15-mile radius. They tried to avoid it. They tried to talk the doctor defendants into, well, let's do it this way. You open the new hospital and you do the inpatient surgery down, and we'll have this outpatient surgery, and you do all your outpatient surgery there, or you don't do any outpatient surgery at the new hospital.
Mr. Gilstrap, these facts aren't really pertinent to the grounds that we granted the permissive appeal on, which is strictly whether 12.01 prohibits the granting of consent.
Well, that's true, but interpreting 12.01, you have to understand that there is a fiduciary duty on the part of the general partner, and that is something that has to be considered in interpreting that provision. Now, I won't go on and tell the rest of the story about how Baylor, in counsel's words, was unable to restrain itself from temptation and open the new hospital and basically in the process of destroying our hospital. It's a blatant conflict of interest. I'll come back to that on the breach of fiduciary duty. But Justice Walker, you're correct. Let's look at the statute. Excuse me. Let's look at the contractual provision. It says that the doctor defendants can't open a competing facility without the prior written consent of the general partner, which consent may be withheld at its sole and absolute discretion. Okay? They say that you need to read this to mean which consent may be withheld or granted at its sole and absolute discretion. What's the difference? Well, there's a huge difference. The reason that it is written this way is to make it easy for the general partner to say no. Doctor comes in, I want to open a clinic across the street, and here's what we're going to do. And the general partner says, you know, best interest of the partnership to say no, and I'm going to say no. The sole and absolute discretion prevents the doctor who wants to jump ship from coming in and saying, oh, no, it's not reasonable. You know, that's always how you attack a consent provision, and say, well, the decision was unreasonable. If it says sole and absolute discretion, it can't be attacked as unreasonable. Well, why shouldn't we also have a provision saying that sole and absolute discretion to withhold or grant consent, which is what they want? The reason being that it is not to the best interest of the partnership to grant consent. The reason this covenant is in here for a reason, to keep people from competing with the partnership. It's lawful.
Well, what would be the point of giving them sole discretion to deny consent if they didn't have any power to grant it?
Well, they do have the power to grant consent. That's their argument. They say, oh, no, that you can't ever deny consent or can never grant consent. That's what they're saying. So, therefore, our interpretation is meaningless. There are circumstances under which the general partner might want to grant consent. For example, the doctor who wants to jump ship might be about to open a facility and perform a particular procedure that is not financially sensible to the general partner. It won't work at the surgery center. He could grant consent under those circumstances. Also, he might be about to do a controversial procedure. What if he's going to open an abortion clinic? The GP might want to say, yeah, I'm going to consent. But his standard is in consenting is not measured by sole and absolute discretion. His standard is measured by his duty to the partnership, which are, one, to make a profit. And when the GP ostensibly granted consent, now there's an issue here. We say they didn't grant consent, and we got one of John Bond's.
Mr. Gilstrap, the fact issue of whether or not the consent was reasonable or unreasonable or was in breach of a fiduciary duty or not in breach of a fiduciary duty, as long as the general partner has the authority to grant consent, then that's the construction of the provision, and the fact issues can be hammered out in the trial court.
Well, that's true, but you've got to decide whether
the parameters of the ability to grant consent?
What's that?
The parameters of the ability to grant consent?
Yes, because they are saying that you can't have it doesn't make any sense to have this provision because we're saying that the general partner can never grant consent. No, we say that there are some rare circumstances when it's in the best interest of the partnership and consistent with the general partner's fiduciary duty that he can grant consent. That's all we're saying. That's why the provision makes sense. Their provision, they say, this provision doesn't make sense, so ignore it.
All right, so you're saying that the ability to deny consent is unfettered, but the ability to grant consent is limited by the fiduciary duty and the obligations to the...
Yes, and the contractual obligation to make a partnership. That's you've got it correct, exactly. Now, there are also provisions that the court can look at to decide the meaning of this, which are not in Section 12.1, and particularly I'm talking about Section 18.2. It says the general partner can take an action that favors one limited partner over another, provided it does not adversely affect any limited partner. Well, clearly, this provision, granting consent, favored one of the doctor defendants over the other limited partners, but it also hurt our clients. The surgery center's dying, Boscia is prospering. They say, oh no, that's a conflict with our provision. No, you harmonize those provisions. That is another reason why the discretion that the general partner only has sole and absolute discretion to grant consent, to deny consent, not sole and absolute discretion to grant consent. We put up several arguments, and they haven't challenged any of them. They haven't challenged our plain meaning argument. They haven't addressed the arguments involving the purpose of limited partnership to grant consent to make money or the breach of fiduciary duty. They do say Section 10.5 somehow allows this. Section 10.5 is not involved. Clearly, under Section 10.5, Baylor could come in and open a competing facility, but they couldn't get the general partner to grant consent for our doctors to leave. Section 10.5 does not affect the, doesn't say anything about the general partner except that it says it can open a competing facility somewhere outside Arlington. So 10.5 doesn't get them there. It's contrary. Their argument is contrary to 8.2. They don't have any, they don't have an answer to our argument that the purpose is to make it easy for the GP to say no, but not to make it easy for the GP to say yes. Finally, they don't have any argument concerning, well, let me just say this. The point is, they say the GP has discretion. The GP doesn't have discretion to deny consent. You've got to rewrite that provision. We've come up with arguments that they haven't answered. The best they can do is throw up a bunch of cases and say, well, these cases support us and they want you to do it just that way. We rule for that the GP had had sole and absolute discretion to grant consent. See these cases. That's the type of opinion they would like to see come out of this court. But in fact, when you read the cases, none of them have anything to do with the construction of a consent clause. They only have something to do with the validity of the consent clause. The consent clause is fine. It's enforceable. Judge Sutterth got it right when she ruled that it only gives the GP sole and absolute discretion to grant consent. That's what it says. It is silent as to the authority of the GP, sole and absolute discretion to withhold consent. It is silent as to the authority of the GP to grant consent. That's what she said. She's right. And as Justice Walker says, that's the only issue before the court. I believe that's all.
She said was she was not yet convinced that
interpretation
was
then that's another reason to affirm the decision, because it's even easier there. You see what I'm saying? She said that it only gives sole, it does give sole and absolute discretion to grant consent, and it does.
Withhold consent.
Withhold consent, and it does. But they want you to come in and say that it has sole and absolute discretion to grant consent, and Judge Sutterth didn't say that.
But my point is, why does that, that doesn't matter. We're construing the first sentence of the partnership agreement in section 12.01,
okay.
And the only issue that I see is whether or not the general partner can grant consent.
Yes, I think that's right. I think you got it.
And if the general partner can grant consent, then that disposes of the construction of the clause.
Yes, at that point, Judge Sutterth got it wrong.
Okay.
So, but they don't have an argument as to why the general partner can grant consent, has sole and absolute discretion to grant consent. They don't have that.
What's the difference between can grant consent and has sole and absolute discretion to grant consent for purposes of construing the clause? How does that make any difference for purposes of our construction of this clause?
Because the question is, in the trial, will be, assuming that consent was given, did the general partner breach the contract and breach the contract? That's the only issue left. If he did not have sole and absolute discretion to grant consent, he did breach the contract. And we have our breach of contract claim left. He also breached his fiduciary duty, and that issue was decided against us. But you still have the power in construing this clause to consider the general partner's fiduciary duty and the general partner's breach of that fiduciary duty, and you are not constrained by the trial court's decision on the breach of fiduciary duty claim. You can't reverse it, but you can certainly put language in there that will let the trial court decide whether that issue should still go forward, it can go forward to trial.
Be reversing it, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. If you say that the GP does not have sole and absolute discretion to grant consent, I think I got that right, and one of the reasons is that it's inconsistent with his fiduciary duty, then you are construing that sentence. That language is certainly inconsistent with the trial court's decision to deny our claim for breach of fiduciary duty, but you don't have the power to do that. You simply send the case back, and the trial judge has the power to reconsider that, and he may or may not do it. All right, I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions? All right, thanks, Frank. Marshall?
Thank you, Justice. I don't think I can understate the mischief that would arise from the construction that was just urged to you. First of all, as you correctly point out, Justice Walker, then Judge Sutterth granted all of our motions on claims of breach of fiduciary duty and dismissed those. And that awaits another day, I suppose. What is the standard, then, that is supposed to be applied in determining if we have to have two heads of this, two different sides of this decision-making coin? The only standard that is stated in the contract is sole discretion. Sole discretion to withhold, and just perforce of pure grammar and logic, total discretion to grant. And think of the mischief that would arise if you did what my dear colleague just suggested that you should do. For example, say I stupidly decide to make dangerous renovations to my apartment, and my landlord, with equal stupidity, agrees to give consent to that. And then someone is injured. Is the landlord now guilty of breach of contract for unreasonably consenting to the changes? Say a baseball player is traded, and the team has buyer trader's remorse and gains his consent, and he then becomes the batting champion of the league next year. Is the contract now voided because the consent was, quote, unreasonably given or given in breach of some fiduciary duty? The point is, the decision that is committed to the general partner is the decision of whether to allow an investment in a potentially competitive entity. That decision is clearly one of sole discretion.
But I have a question. It seems to me we've almost come full circle in this, because even if the general partner has sole discretion to grant consent, say that's the construction, the general partner has sole discretion to grant consent, that still doesn't shield the general partner from any other claims that could be brought against him or the entity concerning any exercise of that discretion, just as in the trial court, just as the example you pointed out with evidence. I mean, the trial court has sole discretion to admit or exclude evidence, but it doesn't mean that the action can never be challenged.
Oh, and that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just simply suggesting that the standard that is applicable to determine the action of the GP here is sole discretion, just as it is with whole. Real quickly, 18.2 is not inconsistent at all with our interpretation. It says that if contractual provisions are not adhered to, the general partner may do certain things. Here, the protocol of 12.1 was exactly followed. He says that there's some inconsistency between the exercise of this discretion and the best interest of the partnership. Well, clearly the grant of summary judgment on the breach of fiduciary duty claims belies that, but that aside, it's the discretion of the general partner who bears the financial risk of the operation, owns the largest percentage, to make that determination. That's why the language reads as it does. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. The case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.